This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Later today, we'll hear the miraculous story of a Fort Myers teen who was successfully revived after his heart stopped when he went into cardiac arrest 2 days before Christmas. A sudden cardiac arrest is the leading cause of death of student athletes. We'll explore when and how kids should get cardiac screenings. But first, we delve into the works featured in a provocative new exhibit through the Florida Gulf Coast University Library Archives and Special Collections, exploring the pervasive issue of rape and sexual assault and how rape manifests in contemporary culture. The exhibit explores these issues through the world of underground art and writing. The exhibition, Rape Culture, Zines and Artist Books, addresses these difficult issues through art books and through zine platforms dating back to the 1970s. FGCU staff and students spent the last 18 months researching and collecting the writings, illustrations, and other artifacts included in the exhibit that spans nearly five decades. Joining me now in studio is Melissa Vandenberg, an FGCU librarian and head of archive, special collections, and digital initiatives. Melissa, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi, John.
Also with us in studio are two FGCU students. One's graduated. One will graduate this spring. Kenzie Brown and Kaylee Dietrich, thank you so much for being with us as well and taking the time and for your work curating this exhibit.
Thank you so much for having us. It's so exciting to be here. Thank you.
All right. And I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. Phone lines are open at 239-590-2580. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And to start off, Melissa, I wanted you to just give our listeners maybe a better idea about your background as it relates to issues tackling this exhibition. When we spoke last week, you'd mentioned that, you know, this is something you've really been an advocate about for some 25 years.
It is. I was an artist before I became a librarian. Not that they're mutually exclusive, but mm-hmm. one life kind of begat the other. And body image and rape culture and how the media affects women has always been the topic for me.
And tell us a bit about the idea of this exhibition, how it first began to manifest. And by that, I'm talking about the She Will Fade Theatrical Art Collective, which, by the way, this is the second consecutive week that that art collective has been brought up on our show because they're going to be performing for Mira Roberts' art exhibition, which opens next week at the Sydney and Byrne Davis Art Center. That's another story. But tell us a bit about that group and sort of how that kind of got you started down this path.
Yeah, so the genesis of this exhibition came from me being introduced to Megan Schindler, and she was the initial creator of the She Will Fade Collective. And she had collected, after her own assault, started to collect stories and ethnographies from survivors. So this, of course, keyed me in. I was very interested. The archive wanted to play a role in preserving them and making them accessible. And that became really tricky for us because we wanted them to remain anonymous.
Right.
So there's a moment when we didn't want to give them numbers, but we have to create some way of them being discovered in the first place. And so we started to reach out to the people that she had collected these ethnographies from and ask them basic questions so that we could create an avatar of them. And that included their sexual orientation, their race, their place of birth, and their gender, and how they identified for each four of those. And it just kind of evolved from there as the stories I started to realize how pervasive it was at universities. It felt like it was important for us to tell these stories to a larger audience.
Are these survivor stories all from local people?
Not all of them. A large portion of them, yes.
Okay. And when we had talked before as well, you know, you had mentioned that you really strive to be diverse among the survivors and whose stories you wanted to tell, but that at least when it came to sex, gender, mm-hmm. That was something of a challenge. Why?
As I take a breath to think it through. We really wanted to be inclusive of all ethnicities and genders, and we found it easier to find different ethnicities among women. Finding men that were creating zines or artist books or really any written kind of form based on their assault was really difficult. And those that we did find were too graphic to include in this show. And I think that generally comes from the sense that even though shame affects all victims of assault, I think our culture has created it to where even more shame is applied to men that are victims of assault. And that's really heartbreaking. And we were really saddened by the fact that we couldn't include them. But they are definitely with us today in spirit as we open up the show.
Yeah. And Kinsey, you're going to be graduating this spring, I think, as we mentioned. I'm not sure if that was before we turned the mics on or not, but
yes, I will be.
Preemptive congratulations to you there.
Thank you so much.
Tell me about what you're studying and perhaps how it relates, if it relates, to your involvement in this exhibition.
Well, Melissa and I actually met. She was my instructor before she was my boss. We met on a study abroad trip to Ireland, which is kind of our common thread between the three of us here. But Melissa and I met, and that was where – I'm actually an English major, and I plan on getting a master's in that. But Mel really sparked my interest in preservation and museum work. And so from there, I was offered this opportunity to come and work with this incredible exhibition. And so it's really opened my eyes to kind of my ultimate career path, and that I really do want to work in museums and being able to kind of preserve these voices in a way that – not only legitimizes, but kind of proliferates them for people to see and research and ultimately hear.
And what about you, Kaylee? How did you get involved?
Well, I just graduated with my master's in history. And so all throughout my bachelor's and my master's degree, I worked in women's history and feminist history in some aspect. It's something I've always felt a passion for, really getting those unheard voices out and preserving them for the public. And I've always wanted to work in archives, so I just popped into Melissa's office and said, hey, let me help you do something. And so she introduced me to this project, and it's really opened my eyes a lot more and helped me work with new people and see other backgrounds. And I just love working on it, especially with my field.
And yeah, I don't mean to go off on too much of a tangent here, but I was really curious whenever Melissa told me that, you know, you had this sort of specialty in your study on feminism in Ireland.
Yes.
What prompted that interest?
My family is Irish. My great-grandparents are from Carlow, Ireland, a bit south of Dublin. So it's been something that I've always grown up with. And researching the history behind it, since I've always been a lover of history, I found the feminist experience and the experience of women in Ireland is so different from their neighbors in Britain and even in America that they deserve their own space to speak about their experience, especially with their relationship with the Catholic Church. So that's just something that I've always loved and wanted to research.
Interesting. Maybe we'll have to do a podcast or something about this. I don't want to get too far off. Yeah, right.
I'm going to keep her as long as I can.
Right. Well, let's just take a step back for those who are maybe unfamiliar. Just tell us generally what we're talking about when we refer to zines and art books.
So zines are an underground form of art. They're a lot of the times considered trash art because they're so cheaply made and they're traded a lot of the times for free or in exchange of other zines, and they're filled with poetry and art and stories. So this was really a way to get an intimate look at people's experiences, specifically with rape and sexual assault. It was very uncensored, which is what we loved about it.
Mm-hmm. And zines have been used for centuries as far as in social movements. So the Zapatistas, the suffragettes, they've all used them as a way of inexpensively pushing out information that they wanted the masses to get, not necessarily people that could afford to buy a newspaper, but people that really wanted to hear what was really going on in an uncensored fashion. So they're a very powerful medium.
And art books, I understand, are maybe considered maybe a little bit of a higher form, but they're also pretty underground too.
Artist books, I would absolutely consider them a form of high art. And, it, you know, in the realm of art, they are considered high art. And so an artist book is kind of – we describe it as an intersection kind of between what a book is and what art is. Uh-huh. So the artist book, it looks to explore and kind of subvert what we classically think of as a traditional bound volume. So within an artist book, an artist might use something that looks like a book, but when you open it up, it opens into a vast accordion – complicated, you know, a folding of paper.
Yeah.
And so they take these things, and artist books aren't necessarily made to be flipped through from first page to end page. A lot of these even open up and they're kind of a circular form. So they kind of subvert our classical expectations of what it is to sit down, open a book.
Yeah. Do you think there's kind of a degree of form following function here when you're using – I mean, because here zines are something that really give a voice to people who might not otherwise have one. And you're telling the stories of people whose voices are often marginalized in our society.
I do. And I think that both forms actually serve to be able to give an honest expression in really the way that artists truly do. So even though artist books are still in this book form, they're created to provide emotion. So they're visual. They're not only to be read, but they're also visual, three-dimensional pieces of art in and of themselves.
All right. Well, we are talking about the Rape Culture Zines and Artist Books exhibit at Florida Gulf Coast University. The opening reception for that exhibit actually takes place this evening here at Florida Gulf Coast University in the library up on the third floor. I got a chance to preview it. I'd recommend anybody come out and see it. But listeners can join our conversation as well. Phone lines are open at 239-590-2580. And specifically, maybe from each of you, if there was maybe just like one or two things that are in this exhibit that to you just speak to you specifically or just break your heart, like what can you maybe tell us about those stories or artifacts or something that just struck you?
One of the pieces that I was really interested in getting was actually a Doonesbury comic. A couple of years ago, the artist for Doonesbury, he put out a whole series on sexual assault in the military. And we, as women, keep trying to take their place in the military and be equal to the men in the military. We keep seeing them constantly being knocked down and their voices silenced with their experiences. And so to have this other form of art on display to really open up that discussion that this is still a serious problem within the military really was something I felt was important to include.
What about you, Melissa?
It's really difficult to pick one. I think probably one of my favorite pieces is the cover of an issue of Just Call Me Woe, and it's from the 90s. So as a Gen Xer, of course, I was biased. and what I love about the cover is it takes this classic Renaissance profiles of women and then plays down on them as far as like morphing their chastity belts, their corsets, in kind of almost a steampunk fashion. Mm-hmm. But there's locks on certain private parts of their body. But I love that they kind of played with this notion that this has been happening to women for a long time, right, that we've been chattel for a long time.
And what about you, Kaylee?
Kinsey,
but, I'm sorry.
A lot of confusion. No worries. But one of my favorite pieces in this exhibition is an artist's book titled Jarring Three by an artist named Mirabel Jones. Her project with this artist's book was she put out a set of three mason jars, and she invited women, victims, survivors, to submit parts of their story into these jars. So in the first jar, she asked them to put the context of their assault. In the second, she asked them to put words or phrases that they associated with the assault itself. And then in the final jar, she asked them to put kind of their reflections or how they were affected by their assault. And so she took the submissions from 22 people, and she was able to print a set of three artists' books corresponding to each of the jars. So the first volume recounts kind of the contexts of all of these various assaults that these women went through. Second, documents their feelings, and this book is for lack of a better word, it's jarring to look at. It's aggressive and red and violent. And then the third one is actually bound. It's bound in handmade paper, but what she has done is she's embedded pieces of broken glass into the cover of the book. So to even handle the book is dangerous and thorny. So she's created kind of a visual, an emotional representation of the various processes of rape. And what I felt was so important about this was the collaborative effort of this piece. She included not just her voice, not just the voice of people she knew, but of 22 anonymous survivors that have been compiled into kind of this volume of raw emotion.
And I'm trying to imagine the three of you over this 18-month period sifting through all these stories. Reading a lot of really disturbing stuff. And I'm just wondering how it impacts you. What kind of a toll does this take on you mentally or emotionally? And do you just have moments where you have to get up and walk away from it? What has that been like? I know that's a really personal question.
It's really rough. I know Kinsey and I spent a lot of time reading through oral histories and ethnographies of women. And they're just so detailed and really heavy. There have been moments that we had to get up and walk away. Some of these stories are 10, 15, 20 pages long, so they do take a toll on you. But the importance of the project always overpowers that. That's our main goal. And it may be hard for us to read. We all either know somebody or have experience with sexual assault, so it's important for us to remember that we're trying to bring these voices to life and make the public more known that this is an issue that we still face in society.
Yeah. One of the first questions I think it was the first question I asked Melissa when we met last week was, what put this up on your radar? And her response was like, well, I'm a woman and I have a pulse, so it's kind of always been on my, you know. And I do think that that's going to, you know, be a distinction between how men generally and how women generally are going to experience this. That's not a question.
I think that the weight of this, I mean, one of the things that, you know, as an educator working with the interns and selecting these pieces was, how do we tell these stories? And ultimately, when we were making the decision of what pieces to put up and we were framing them and putting them in chronological order, and was if each one of these women were standing in this room, would they be proud of what we have done?
That's heavy. Yeah. I wanted to delve into one piece that you feature in here, and it's something that stuck out to me, I think, most of all from what I've seen so far, and I can't wait to come back and check more of it out. But these was the images from a kind of a fetish comic book style series called Knights of Horror. Give us some context, Melissa.
Well, this was actually their discovery.
Okay.
I know very little about comic books. And at first I was like, it doesn't fit. So we had said we wanted to do from 1970 to present. So when they – anytime they found something that was outside of the scope of the show that we had set up, they kind of had to bring it to me and explain it. And at first I was like, comic books, no, it's not relevant. It's so relevant. And it actually became the piece that we started the show with, as a representation of what we were pushing against. Mm-hmm. Do one of you want to share specifics about the book?
Yeah, I stumbled upon this volume as I was searching through a database. And these images are not taken directly from a comic book. These are actually they're pulp fiction novels from the 50s, which were
smut.
For lack of a better word, that's exactly it. And I mean, these were the kinds of novels that they weren't advertised in bookstores, but if you slid the guy, you know, 50 cents, he'd hand it to you underneath the table.
Well, there were laws against this. Yeah.
Precisely. Yeah. And so these kinds of fetish pulp fiction, they were an outlet, and it unfortunately manifested in some pretty horrific depictions of rape scenes as it being portrayed as fetish. And so when I found this, I kind of stopped and I went, wait, this was in the 50s. This was not that long ago. And this was popular fiction. This was what people were seeing. And then I saw the name, Joe Shuster.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, this is Superman. This is the man that created Superman, who is kind of the icon of Americana. And then on the side, this is what he was doing with his time. So I think it provides a really interesting context about kind of where we came from and where we stand historically as far as rape culture and where it fits into our sexuality and kind of how we approach it.
Something I find really just cognitively dissonant about it is these images you're talking – and again, I've seen – I went looking for other ones because you told me these are the only four we could show.
Right.
But some of the really graphic ones, and I don't necessarily think this was intentional. It might just be his drawing style, but it looked like Superman and Lex Luthor. And it was just really jarring.
And even Lois Lane.
Yeah, and Lois, of course.
If you look at the women in these images, they look an awful lot like Lois.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's really disturbing for me was that even in these scenes where these women are being brutalized, their hair is perfectly coiffed.
Yes.
And they always have high heels on.
Mm-hmm.
Because we want to make sure that we look good when we're being beaten.
Right. Yeah, it's just the sensible choice. Stilettos.
Obviously.
It was also interesting because these books led to a lot of legal cases, you know, First Amendment arguments. And reading in that, I found that kind of what people were upset about wasn't just the fetish obscenity, but just because he was drawing bare-breasted women and because it included scenes of, you know, interracial sexual activity and even lesbianism. It wasn't.
For shame.
Yeah. It was just interesting that, you know, from the lens of 1950s, what was happening to the women in these, that wasn't necessarily the issue.
Well, and I'm not sure that lens has changed all that much. And I think that that's the piece that's the most terrifying for us, is that when you dive into this deeply, other than just living it in our day-to-day lives. It isn't the fact that these women are being damaged or hurt because they are objects. And so even in the – like what people are objecting to is not our objectification. They're objecting to the fact that we're doing something that they consider morally wrong, not what the man is doing morally wrong to the woman in the images.
Right, right, right. And I think that really kind of – I think you've addressed sort of the elephant in the room as far as this conversation goes. And I imagine you would all – there was one you were telling me in particular about these stories that – save for one that involved hitchhiking, any of these could have been written today.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We were discussing that this is a really timely – exhibition, but it's also a timeless topic, unfortunately. We could have done this exhibition a year ago and it still would have been a timely topic, which is so, so sad. But that's why this project is so important.
Yeah. And I think it's very interesting how this the timing of this exhibition being completed is so serendipitous with the Me Too movement, and, you know, which continues to grow and empowering more women to come forward and, you know, say this happened and this isn't okay.
Mm-hmm. And the incredible verdict yesterday.
Yes, of course. Oh, my gosh. Dr. Nassar, of course.
I love that judge. I thank you personally.
But again, this is something that you guys started well before you could have known we'd be in this moment now. Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking, but really, is there ever a time where this wouldn't have seemed like serendipitous? Like what if this had come out, say, mm-hmm. You know, when we were looking at the trial with Anita Bryant? You know, I mean, there's always – it seems like there's always going to be something mm-hmm. in the news that would make this relatable because, as you said, the situations haven't really changed.
Okay.
I guess so. What do you want people who experience this to walk away from it with?
You know, I've given that a lot of consideration. And I think that the hope is that a dialogue happens. I think in a lot of people's lives, there's just a conversation starting to happen regarding Me Too, regarding Time's Up, regarding, you know, Nassar. And as long as people are talking about it and a dialogue is happening, then people are being educated. And multiple sides are being heard. And the goal of this is that the victims are no longer silent and that we give them room to be heard and for people to take the time to hear them.
Do you think or at least hope that in future generations that this source material from this exhibit will one day seem dated in a way that today it just doesn't?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. At the beginning of the show, a lot of things were happening. Between meeting Megan and She Will Fade and my daughter going off to university.
Mm-hmm.
And so when those layers become personal for us, and that's one of the things that's really important, no matter what statistic you're looking at, it falls between 1 in 4 to 5 women. So if you're standing in a room of 5 women, you are standing there with someone. This affects everyone. And if people don't think that it has affected someone that they love, they are wrong.
Right. Let's maybe just delve into a couple more of the individual pieces in here. There's something there from 70s performance artist Suzanne Lacey. Can you tell us about that piece and why you included it?
Sure. Well, I think that she's a god. as is usual, I think most, 90s artists look back at the 70s artists and millennials look back to the 90s artists. It's just we learn from those that come before us. And so for me, Suzanne Lacey was prolific in her work. And this particular book called Rape is a very simple, all-white book with a red sticker on the front that says rape. And then on the left side of each, opening of the book, on the left page, it says rape is. And then there's one or two sentences that gives an example of what rape is. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that was terrifying for me was my partner was reading through it and he was looking through it. And except, like you mentioned earlier, the one that mentions hitchhiking, because that's not a term used much today.
Yeah.
All of them were applicable to today. Mm-hmm. It really was timeless. And this piece was done in 1976. And every single page could be today.
Yeah. You know, and of course, not every piece is from the 70s. You know, there's this reproduced portrait of William Kennedy Smith from 1993 after he was tried and acquitted of rape in Palm Beach in 91. And further in the gallery, there's a 2017 piece that I think it really immediately draws the eye, a simple neon yellow rectangle with a black and white newspaper style headline that reads, "Things that last longer than Brock Turner's prison sentence." And below it are cutouts of batteries, a tube of mascara, a bar of soap, and a toothbrush. I mean, this aspect of rape culture, you know, not just the boys will be boys language carried through the decades and generations, this, you know, what many would argue lack of fair trial and punishment, is this part ever going to change? You know, even if people stop asking victims what they are wearing, for example, I mean, do you believe the judicial system will change with society, before society?
I mean, I think that Larry Nassar's ruling yesterday kind of proves that things already are changing. I mean, this movement that has been going on with Me Too, with Time's Up, this is a level of momentum that this issue has never gained before. And people are listening in a way that they really have not before. And so now our show kind of capitalizes on that, and we're hoping that we can just move forward and start this real conversation about what is actually going on, and hopefully that reaches out into other areas. You know, if you start with art, perhaps it'll reach into law. Perhaps it'll reach into popular culture. I mean, that's how these things tend to start, is with art.
Yeah. And particularly, I think for Kinsey and Kaylee, I was wondering if you felt like you were coming into this maybe with a little bit of a disadvantage just from being younger and, you know, not having direct experience, presumably, with living in the 1970s.
I feel like you just called me old.
I'm with you. I did zines in high school. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, we were very fortunate in that the zine community is still very alive.
Yeah.
It's very, very alive. We worked with a local zinester, Angela, who runs Love Your Rebellion, and she put us in touch with all of her friends all throughout Florida who are still producing zines and artist books and putting these publications out. So we were aware of it a little bit. Our difficulty came in really finding them. With how they're categorized, with how the keywords are noted on eBay or Amazon or Abe Books. So finding them was more of the difficulty, but we were pleasantly surprised to find that this form of art is still around and the current zinesters have those connections with the Gen Xers and with those who worked in the 1970s.
And just FYI, I've actually been in talks with Angela Page. She's going to be on the program next week. So she's going to be coming back.
You know. That's exciting. And just to speak a bit more to the zine experience, I actually went into this project not knowing what a zine was, I'll readily admit it. But now part of our – we've really been inspired by this project because these zines have revealed themselves as such a valuable ethnography of information. Yeah. They have these viewpoints that really I and these ladies sitting with me really feel are – academically and historically important. And so part of the reason that this project is so crucial is that here at FGCU, we're actually hoping to start a zine archive to really preserve these voices and legitimize them as actual academic reference material.
Oh, I think that's a great idea. And I have to ask what your research process was like and where you found a lot of this source material, because this is unlike most any other type of exhibit. You can't just use some like online search database to find a you know, article that was published in a peer-reviewed journal. You know, that's not where you're going to find this stuff.
Well, our big touchstone was actually the University of Miami's Firefly zine collection. Uh-huh. They were benevolent enough to let us kind of graze through it, and actually some of our selections that are featured in the show are from the Firefly zine collection. So we were really inspired by their system, but we – In our research, we bought stuff off Etsy, we bought stuff off Amazon. We really went looking to find these zines wherever they may be, and we found them, and now they're here, and we get to keep them, and our students get to access them.
And additionally, too, I went to a couple zine fests locally, and largely due to Angela reaching out to her community, people were incredibly generous in donating them, and then I would contact them afterwards so that they would have like my contact information and they could continue to send me stuff being created. Because it's being created here locally. And I think it's imperative that the library here, that lives here, is collecting material being generated here.
And Melissa, you had mentioned to me earlier that for this exhibition, the process of pinning down precisely what the scope would be was just difficult in a way that tackling other topics isn't. Why is that?
Because they're stories. And you're not necessarily just picking a piece of art that you could say, okay, we're going to do a show based on early print works from the 1500s. That's not the way the show works. And because there's no way – well, I guess for some people, you could remove the emotion. You would come across things that were powerful and you wanted to include. Initially, we had the idea with the scope that it would be Florida. But we realized we would be losing monumental pieces that would really help us tell the story fully if we kept it only to Florida. We would lose the books by like Suzanne Lacy and Jarring Three. So it was important to expand the scope. We did want to make sure that everything that we showed highlighted the fact that rape is not about sex. That was actually in huge bold letters on what we call the war board. This is not about sex. This is about power. So if it fit in, if it sexualized it, we did not include it.
Interesting.
Well, with the exception of the Joe Shuster material,
that
was included as kind of, like I said, context. Yeah. It's the touchstone for the entire exhibition because you walk in and you see these images and you go, my God, this was the 50s. And then from there you build, well, what was the reaction to this kind of portrayal?
Right. Well, great conversation. Unfortunately, we do have to leave it there for now. But we've been speaking with Florida Gulf Coast University librarian and head of archives, special collections, and digital initiatives, Melissa Vandenberg, along with Kinsey Brown and Kaylee Dietrich here at Florida Gulf Coast University, who also curated this exhibition. It's been great speaking with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
The opening reception for the exhibit Rape Culture, Zines and Artist Books takes place this evening from 5:30 to 7:30 at the FGCU Library Archives. That's on the third floor. The exhibition runs through April 18th. We're taking a short break, but when we return, we hear the miraculous story of recovery from a Fort Myers teen who was revived after he went into sudden cardiac arrest just nearly 2 months ago. Given that cardiac arrest is the leading cause of death for student athletes, we'll hear his story and explore when and how young people should get cardiac screenings. That's just ahead. Stay with us. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida.